soll ich dran gehen?
Sorry.
Wie machen wir es mit dem... Also, ich setze jetzt an.
We just had to try and mistranslate him because those two don't understand English that well, and but he is translating for them.
No, that's good. No, we can't start yet. Florian is not here.
Oh, she's not here?
I don't see her. Is she? Is she? No.
No. Oh,
she's yes, here? She's here. Yeah. So. Okay, so we can start.
Okay, you have your... Yes. So, I'm very pleased that I can introduce Eva Jablonka to you. Some of you might know her because of her book, Evolution in Four Dimensions, which she published together with Marion Lamb in 2005, right? And this was when we heard, our group heard her name the first time, and we read this book, we were quite excited about this book, and we thought this is really helping to going on with those subjects, evolution and breeding. And that's why we are very glad that we could invite her to talk about these subjects to us. Right now, Eva is working in the Cohen Institute in Tel Aviv, and she is a molecular biologist.
Geneticist. I was trained as one.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you very much, Eva.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I knew that I'm going to talk to people who are dealing with breeding in agriculture, and it's not topics that are really some that I'm familiar with. So I was trying to think about things that I know a little bit about more and that can be that are related to breeding. And domestication is obviously related to breeding because even now when we are breeding and selecting, we are doing a process of domestication. It's not exactly the same process that our ancestors did when they first domesticated cows and dogs and chicken and so on. But it is a continuation of the same basic process. So I want to talk about the things that go into domestication, into the kind of variation that happens when humans domesticate animals. So, of course, I have to give thanks to the people who are responsible for these ideas and this work, and these are the people. And I want to start with domestication. What is it? And this is a definition that I took from one of the books that are dealing with the subject. And it's saying that this is the taming of wild animals and plants by humans. Animals are often herded, and their care and feeding becomes dependent upon humans, while plants are formed and often become dependent upon humans for propagation. Domestication changes the physical characteristic of the plants and animals involved. And also, domestication altered the evolution of humans themselves. Without domesticating animals, we would not be here, and I would not be giving this lecture. So, the process of domestication, according to this definition, is changing many characteristics. One of the things that it is doing is that it is making the plants and animals, to a large extent, dependent on humans. This is one thing which is quite important and very interesting. And also, when we're thinking about taming, when we're thinking about animals, we're talking about taming wild animals. And by taming, we mean making them more docile, less aggressive, less frightened. Another thing that happens when we're domesticated animals is that we make them, their breeding patterns have to conform with what we want, not what they want. So we are very often breaking the normal normal mechanisms of mate choice or changing them. These are things that are obvious, but they nevertheless they have to be said because very, very often we forget about them. Not you, but a lot of people. Now, this is the thing that Darwin was very impressed on. In The Origin of Species, in the first chapter, he's talking about domestication as a model for evolution. And the animal that he's focusing on the domestication of is the pigeon. And here is we see the rock dove and several different types, variants that have been selected by men, some very bizarre ones in many ways, probably wouldn't survive terribly well in the wild. Now, what did Darwin do? What was domestication for Darwin? He used domestication for two things, one of which usually we hear about a lot and the other one we hear about very little. The first thing that we hear about a lot is he used domestication as a model for natural selection. He said, during domestication we are using artificial selection, and artificial selection is a kind of selection, and there is something like that, not quite like that, different in many ways, but nevertheless something like that going in nature. So we can use domestication and the results of selection as a model for understanding what natural selection is about. This is the first thing that he was using it for. The second thing, which people don't talk about very much, but is very clear in both The Origin, in his notebooks from 1844, and also in his big book on variations, variations on plants and animals under domestication, which he wrote in 1868, is he uses domestication as a model for the generation of heritable variations under extreme conditions. So what he's saying is very strange to think that Darwin said it, but he did many times. He's saying that under domestication, the domestication is a condition of stress, usually, for the animal. When we take a wild animal and we put it under the normal, under domestication condition, we're not just changing selection, we are changing it in a very extreme way for this animal. And this kind of extreme conditions in which we put this animal are leading to the generation of new heritable variation in these animals. This is what he said. So not only are we selecting pre-existent variation, but we are increasing the range of variation in the animal through exposing it to very, very extreme conditions. So this is in 84, and he says here very clearly, it's the famous notebook, which was the basis of The Origin of Species, but we'll see what he wrote in The Origin too, the same. Races are made under domestication, first by direct effects of the external condition to which the species is exposed. This is the direct effect of the conditions on whatever the heritable variation is. Second, by the indirect effect of the exposure to new conditions, often aided by excessive food, rendering the organization plastic, and by men selecting and separately breeding certain individuals, or introducing to his stock selected males, or often preserving with care the life of the individual best adapted to his purpose. This is selection. But also the indirect effect is a global kind of effect, which is non-specific, but is increasing generally the plasticity of the animals. And third, he said, by crossing and recrossing races already made and selecting their offspring. Now, if you think that this is just something that he had in his head in 1844, it isn't. It doesn't matter. It's a very long thing here. But he's talking about basically the same thing. I believe that the conditions of life from their action on the reproductive systems are so far of the highest importance as to causing variability. So again, he's talking about the generation of variability. This is one of the things, according to Darwin, that domestication is doing. I do not believe that variability is inherent and necessary contingency under all circumstances with all organic beings, as some authors have taught. The effects of variability are modified by various degree of inheritance and of reversion. Variability is governed by many unknown laws and so on and so forth. And he's talking about this, and then he's ending with selection. That, of course, without selection, we cannot accumulate variation. But we need also to generate them, he says. Okay, so what is variation, heritable variation, which is the stuff on which is the stuff we can select? What are the inputs that change development and that can change also heredity? We all know about genes and DNA. We all know that, of course, different alleles of the same locus, different genotypes, are inputs into development, are different inputs into development. You have different genotypes, you have different phenotypes. You can have, not always. But they certainly are very, very important. But there are other things, too, that are very important for making us what we are, and these are the non-DNA parts of the egg. We can think about aspects of the that are associated with the nucleus, non-DNA aspects of the nucleus, and also the cytoplasm. Early nourishment, if we're thinking about animals, mammals, then we can think about womb and milk. If we're thinking about birds, we can think about the egg and what goes into the egg. From the mother, we know that the hormonal profile of eggs can be different according to many, many criteria, including hatching order, laying order, and things like that. If we're thinking about early development of animals that have maternal care, we can think about parental care or any kind of care. We can think about home and care. And when we're thinking about our own species, we think about social and cultural education, which are very, very much very important for making us what we are. Now, all these things are trivial. We all know that all these things are important to make us what we are. The genes, the non-genetic parts of the egg and the nucleus, the environment in the womb, the early environment, culture, so what? What is interesting and what is important and what is usually not always appreciated is that these things can affect not only us, but also our children and our grandchildren. That these are inputs not only into development, but also into heredity. Now, here I have a picture which I like, and it's called The Five Mothers. Now, forgive me that there are no fathers here. It's not because of sexist reasons. It's just because life is complicated enough as it is, and my friend couldn't manage. So what we have here are the five inputs, basic inputs into development, and I will add to this a little bit. So here we have the DNA input. This is the first mother. Here we have all those inputs that go into the chromatin of the chromosomes, into the chromosomes, the non-DNA aspects of the chromosomes, and into the cytoplasm. Here we have what's happening in the womb, what's happening in early development, and this huge thing around is mother culture. For us, probably the most important input into our development, also into our evolution, because cultural evolution of we are all driven by cultural evolution, and I believe that human evolution, even the evolution of humans as biological beings, the genetic evolution of humans, is also, to a large extent, initiated and driven by cultural evolution. I won't talk about this. I want to add something to this which is not apparent in this complicated enough picture, and that is that our notion of individuality today is also not something that wonderfully clear, right? We have more microorganisms in terms of number of cells than our own eukaryotic cells, more. It's only 1.5 kilo normally, yes? But it's in terms of number, we have more prokaryotic cells in our bodies than we have our own. We are a big colonies, each of us. We are a conglomerate. And we are one big unit with our genomes and with the genomes that live with us. And we have to remember this because when things change and happen to us, they don't happen just to us, they also happen to our symbionts. And when we're thinking about cows, Symbionts are enormously important. If you take a cow from one place to another place, you are immediately changing its food. You are immediately changing, to a large extent, its symbionts. People have made work on Japanese people and on German people. And they have shown that the symbionts in Germany and in Japan are very different. The prokaryotic symbionts are very different because of the different diets, which selects for different different types of bacteria. And this kind of thing we sort of inherit or acquire again and again through the generations. When a child passes through the birth canal, in a normal birth, it drinks. It gets some of the symbionts of its mother by drinking the liquid. And also by being around her, by suckling, by moving around in the flat. If you are too hygienic, maybe the child will not acquire the symbionts. But eventually, we more or less do. And the profile is not identical, but it's very similar. So we have to remember this too. These are also inputs into our development. And we know that without normal symbionts in our guts, we know from research on mice, the gut will not develop normally. And there will be a lot of immune problems as well. But we simply need them. So it's just something that I want to add because it's not shown in this picture. Okay. So it's something that goes here. In our case, in other organisms, symbionts can be transmitted through eggs, through the cytoplasm of the egg, for example. Okay. So all these inputs are inputs both into development. They make us and other animals what they are, what we are. And they are inputs also into heredity in the sense that different genotypes and different inputs of this type can have transgenerational effects. Effects on the next generation and the next generation and so on. So this one we know. I want to say a few words about epigenetic inheritance because this is the most, these are the components that affect development and also affect heredity that are part of the eggs that are transmitted through the egg cytoplasm and through the chromatin of the chromosomes. I won't talk about all of them because it's very, very, it's a big thing and it's too complicated and too long. So I would need another lecture to give about this, but I will give you one example. So what I'm going to talk, I just want to define what epigenetic inheritance is and then I'm going to focus on one mechanism. Epigenetic inheritance is the inheritance of phenotypic variations or developmental predispositions that do not depend on corresponding variation in DNA sequence and on the persistent presence of inducing signals in the present environment. I want to explain this. What it means is that we can have two organisms living in exactly the same environment, so the inducing signals that they get are the same. They also have the same DNA. Yes, we sequence it, it's exactly the same. And yet they are different. And not only are they different, but the differences are inherited. How can it be? Because there is another layer of inheritance, another mechanism of inheritance that can transmit something that happened in ancestral generations to the present. They are different and they inherit it. Now, I want to say a few words about these systems. We now understand what these systems are in quite a lot of biochemical detail. And we can differentiate, make a distinction between different types of epigenetic inheritance. This kind of systems, all of them, allow something that I wrote here that is called soft inheritance. That is, they allow for environmental influence to affect the epigenetic variation, which then can be transmitted. This normally doesn't happen with DNA. And this can happen here because the systems are both regulatory systems and memory systems, inheritance systems. Now, what are the systems? We can talk about systems which are based on self-sustaining loops, regulatory circuits with positive feedback, on something which we call structural inheritance, based on three-dimensional templates, and prions are examples of this. Prions can be transmitted not through the germline in animals, but they can be transmitted from cell to cell, for example, in yeast. And something that I will focus on is chromatin marking, which is very important in a set of inheritance systems. I will talk about one. RNA-mediated inheritance. We learned about small RNAs. Since you are a biologist here, you probably all heard a lot about it. It's a very, very hot topic. And these are the four classes, general classes, and one can give a big lecture about each of them, about each of these classes of inheritance systems, the epigenetic cellular inheritance system that we know, that what they do is they ensure that structural and functional variations are transmitted from one cell generation to the next, not only in somatic cells, also sometimes through the germline. And we can also think about all kinds of things that are transmitted at the whole organism level through hormonal feedback loops, for example, or through the effects of behavior, which recreates behavioral phenotypes, which then reconstruct this behavior. So it is reconstructed along generations. And in the case of humans with symbolic means of communication and representation, we're talking about cultural inheritance. So I promised you that I will talk about one of these things. I will talk about chromatin marking. I'm going to talk about one of the mechanisms of chromatin marking. So here we have a very simplistic representation of how DNA methylation is transmitted. What is DNA methylation? DNA methylation is a modification of one of the cytosines of DNA. This is happening post-replication. Thank you. This is happening post-replication. And the cytosine that is methylated is one that sits next door to a guanosine. So in plants, it's more complicated. It's not only this, but let's leave it for the time being. Life is epigenetically, I think plants are more complicated than animals. And, well, I don't know how it works, but never mind. I do. Ah, okay. Anyway, what we see there, you see there at the top, there are three, I will use the... We have three CGs. So a C near a G, a CG, can be either methylated or not methylated, okay? Now, the methylation or non-methylation in regulatory region has effects on the probability of transcription. So in a very gross way, if a promoter is methylated, transcription is much less likely, okay? So this has effects on gene regulation. Right, so here we have exactly the same DNA base sequence, right? Here, these two CGs are methylated, this one isn't, and this is the mirror image of it, okay? Now, what happens? How is this pattern? Now, these two patterns have different effects on gene transcription, on the transcription of the gene next door. How is it copied, this? What happens is we have a new strand is formed. A new strand is formed, and all the C's near the G's are not methylated. Nothing is methylated. So what you have here is the old strand with the methylation and the new strand without the methylation, and we have these two sites here which are asymmetrical. One strand is methylated, the other isn't. The bit which it wasn't methylated from the beginning is symmetrical. Both strands are unmethylated, right? So this is what we see here. This is the asymmetrical bits, these are the asymmetrical bits, and here, this and this. Now, there is an enzyme, in mammals it's called methyltransferase 1, which when it detects half-methylated sites, it sticks a methyl group on the unmethylated site. When it sees two sites that are both non-methylated, it does nothing. Okay? In this way, the methylation pattern is copied. It's very, very simple, very elegant mechanism. So in this way, we can copy methylation patterns from one cell generation to the next. Of course, the truth is very much more complicated, as usual in biology. There are millions of enzymes involved, and it's related to this, and it's not so simple, and so on and so forth. But basically, this is the story. But it's the same thing with DNA polymerase. If really we want to understand how DNA is replicated, we don't just say there is this nice enzyme, DNA polymerase, which copies the strand. We have to go into a lot of detail. The same here. Anyway, there is this thing. So the DNA methylation is one of the systems that allow the not only are they very important for the regulation of gene activity, they are not the only factor that regulate gene activity, it's one of the factors. It's very important for the regulation of gene activity, and it is a memory system of the cells. Now, here we have identical twins. Not twins. Two mice which are genetically exactly the same. They are identical. The DNA is identical, but they are different, as you can see, rather different. One is enormous and fat and yellow, and the other one is a normal little mouse. The one that is enormous and yellow also has suffers from, of course, obesity and diabetes type 2, and she has a predisposition for tumors, a lot of problems. And the other mouse is normal. So what is the difference between them? Well, first of all, they come from a line with a particular element, transposable, that comes from transposable elements in it. This is the one thing, but they both have this transposable element. So this is not what makes the difference between them. It is a necessary but not sufficient condition for this thing. What is different is that one mouse was given folate and methyl groups donors during the pregnancy of her mum, and the other wasn't. That's the difference. They had the same food, they grew in the same environment. What was different was what their mothers ate. And what their mothers ate during pregnancy affected the methylation status of this gene, of this particular element which sits near a gene which is called agouti. And this is what made it different. So this is a very nice example for the effects of methylation on the phenotype. What happens to the diet of the mother can affect the phenotype of her offspring, and it's a very long-term effect. It's something that happens and stays there. Now, here we have another example, which is very nice, and this is a plant example. This is a plant called Linaria vulgaris, and this was a plant that was very important in the history of biology, because Linnaeus, the famous Linnaeus 250 years ago, it made him change his mind. As you know, Linnaeus thought that all plants and animals were created in the 6 days of more or less by God, as they are. But when a student came and gave him this plant, which was growing, he found this, the pyloric mutant, the pyloric variant over there, this one. This is the normal one. This is the abnormal one. He found this one, and when he found it, Linnaeus was deeply shocked, and he said that it is like having a cow with the head of a wolf, because he classified plants according to the flower, the sex organ. And he changed his mind and decided that maybe God didn't create species after all, but he created genuses, and the genuses created species by hybridization. Anyway, there is a very nice irony in this. These plants are genetically identical, again. And when they were being studied by Enrico Cohen's group in Norwich, Cohen's thought, well, we now, he was studying it just because he wanted to make a nice point, historical point. This was the famous Linnaean plant, so let's see what's happening to it. Because we now know what the genes that are important for flower morphology are. So let's have a look and see what mutation caused it. He looked for a mutation and he didn't find it. What he did find, however, was a change in DNA methylation, which was inherited. So the difference between these two plants is not in their DNA, It is in the pattern of methylation on particular genes, particular loci that are important for flower morphology. And this is inherited at least for two generations. And here is another example that is very important for us, because it's something to do with pollution. What happened here was that Skinner and his colleagues gave a pregnant rat and one injection of stuff called vinclozolin. Vinclozolin is the spray that we put on our vines. It's a fungicide. And he gave it during a particular period of development when she was pregnant, during the day 8 and 15 of gestation. If he gave it at any other time, it didn't work. Okay? This was the critical time. Now, after he gave this injection of vinclozolin is an androgen suppressor, he looked and saw what happened to the offspring, and not surprisingly, the offspring were very, very sick in all kinds of ways, especially the males, but the females also didn't fare very well. But let's look at the males, because males are simpler in terms of epigenetic inheritance, because what they can transmit is either DNA or all kinds of methylation marks on the chromatin or small RNAs. That's it, yeah? The female has all the complications of womb and the cytoplasm and things like that. So let's look at the males. So the males were sick. And the offspring of these males were sick. And the grand offspring of these males were sick. And the great grand offspring of this male were sick. And I don't know what's happening now. And there were many, many factors, many genes that were affected. When he looked at the methylation patterns of all kinds of genes, including many genes that were expressed in the brain, the methylation pattern of these genes was changed, and it was changed in a heritable manner. Okay? So it was a heritable effect. Now, we are not talking about one or two offspring being altered by this vinclozolin. We are talking about 90% of the offspring, and there was no selection involved. No selection because there were no abortions. The number of offspring that was born was exactly the same as in any normal rat. So it was not selection that was working here. And it seems that methylation was important. As I said, methylation is not the only story. And DNA methylation is just one of the chromatin marking inheritance systems. And it is strongly associated with RNA. With the small RNA systems. So the whole story is far more complicated than I'm presenting it here, but nevertheless, certainly DNA methylation was involved in it, and certainly the phenotypic changes were transmitted from one generation to the next, although this offspring, grand offspring and great grand offspring, never saw vinclozolin in their lives. Right? There was nothing. So what we know now is that there are all kinds of poisons, all kinds of changes in the environment, all kinds of shocks can alter the epigenetic profile of animals and plants, and can be transmitted from one generation to the next. And there are many, many examples of these things. And the number is growing all the time. So there is a lot of it. And we cannot yet give, I cannot give you a good systematic characterization of what we know because we don't have it yet. If you can ask me for how many generations, I will tell you between 200 and 100. Yes, it's very big range. Sometimes they are stable, sometimes they are less stable. What causes it? Many things. All kinds of ecological shocks. Hybridization is a genomic shock, which causes not only changes in DNA, obviously, but also very big epigenetic changes. Many things can cause this, can cause a change in the epigenetic profile of animals and plants. And this can be transmitted, not only, it can be transmitted through the germline. The examples that I gave you so far were of transmission through the germline, through the bottleneck of the gamete. However, It's not necessary always to transmit things through gametes. We can have very important intergenerational effects which are not transmitted through the gametes. And let me give you, and yet, the same mechanisms, for example, DNA methylation, are underlying them. Let me give you an example of something that is not transmitted through the germline and yet has intergenerational effects. Here we have maternal behavior in the rat. You probably, many of you probably know this story. It was described by Weaver, it's from Michael Meany's lab in Canada, and it was described by Weaver and his colleagues and the many, many studies on this. So what the rat does is she sort of sits above the offspring and it licks them. And the licking of mammals in our species, the touching of mammals, touching the baby, is very, very important for the maturation, normal maturation of the nervous system or for behavior. If, for example, a mother rat doesn't lick her offspring and sort of grooms them enough, right? And this that in some eat the code now. Fired. very Jack. Russia. Not a dragging the area. Come to looking. That jeans. and the boxes. Female. maybe out. Domestic. other things. Incredibly. New. making sense. Develops a it's something. Pressed. Completely. Because trauma transformation.